Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
You've got to fictionalize. People are entitled to their privacy. But I've met over the years a few of them. I've met mainly boys. You see, it happened while I was at school, but I didn't know what it meant. I saw the signs, and a few old classmates of mine said that the signs were very much eloquent of real abuse happening in private, not involving all the brothers that taught me. I'm only aware myself of one case, and I was never abused myself, and I learned a great deal from some of the men who taught me. But so as soon as you say one thing about the church, you've got to say something else. If the church were only the protective bishops and archbishops and cardinals, then it would be easier to condemn them. But the church is also the people who go out and sit with refugees, the nuns who go out and sit with refugees in our detention centres, and the priests who are activists on their behalf. And So the church is a very contradictory institution at the moment, and I was trying to say that in this book.
Religious leaders see the soul as their executive preserve. The soul is their territory. They think so to hell with psychiatry and psychology, because we control the remission of sins. So the abuser goes to retreat and gets absolution and really believes it won't happen again. But it does. The bishops don't want to face it, that the sacraments aren't everything, can't do everything. Sanctifying grace isn't enough. The powerful words of Australian novelist, playwright and essayist Tom Keneally from his latest book, Crimes of the Father, published by Sceptre Books. Hello, how are you? And you're very welcome to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Have the church gone far enough in supporting victims of clerical child sex abuse? What more needs to happen? And has the Catholic Church lost all moral authority by its words and actions? Well, on tonight's show, I'm going to tackle those questions with Pulitzer Prize-winning novelist Tom Keneally, author of Schindler's Ark, The Daughters of Mars, The Great Shame and The Commonwealth of Thieves. This evening, we're going to unpack the crisis within the church and ask how do we as communities, as families and as friends move on.
This is Tom Keneally. I'm a writer from Australia. I've written about 50 books and am of a great age, 81 years. The book I'm talking about is Crimes of the Father.
Really well done on Crimes of the Father, Tom. It is a powerful read. I have to say it's very funny in parts, very warm, very disturbing in other parts, and deeply uncomfortable. I might throw you a big wide open question to kick things off, and sure, we can take it from there. What does the church mean to you now? I know that you're a former seminarian, and so you've lived through the church and you've left the church. So I'm just wondering, what does it all mean to you now?
Yes, I studied for the priesthood, and you can't undo that. It has an influence on you for life, for positive and, in some cases, negative reasons. I feel very close to the church in a tribal sense. I feel closer to members of my family attending a mass, say, a confirmation mass, as I did the other day. I feel closer to my family than I do to the bishop and those above him who have, I think, let us all down.
Tom, the novel began life as an article that you wrote for The New Yorker, I think, in 2002. Can you tell me about that?
Well, because I studied for the priesthood, The New Yorker asked me to do this piece, tried to examine the phenomenon as a former seminarian, but I did ask for help from some priests I knew. And very notably, a man like my central character, Doherty. Doherty is a man who is has been thrown out of the rather conservative Archdiocese of Sydney, not for any moral turpitude, but for holding certain political views. And he's based on a friend of mine, and I did consult this friend who was in a monastery in the U.S. After he was expelled from the Archdiocese of Sydney. We all said to him, why don't you just leave? He said very authentically, my identity is that of a priest. And so he went to his order's house, and he was a whistleblower and a good soul. And I wanted to honor that. I wanted to honor all the young men I knew in there who were decent human beings. They're not the sort, I'm afraid, who'll ever become cardinals or archbishops, but there are some, they should, and there are some noble people amongst them.
And like in any organisation, Tom, you're always going to get good eggs and bad eggs. You know, that's always the way it plays out. I'm just wondering, the Archdiocese of Sydney comes in for some bashing in Crimes of the Father. And in terms of how you present them, we get a very kind of formal corporate structure, very much like a chief executive management structure on things. And, you know, they're presented as a very slick, tight operation with some very sophisticated players. I'm just wondering, were you conscious you were ruffling possibly some feathers within the church by presenting a spiritual organisation within a kind of a, I suppose, a corporate context or within a corporate frame?
Well, I didn't, to tell you the truth, for this reason, that I think its corporate nature has by now been well illustrated in some of the court cases it took, and in the case of Ireland, by the trouble it's got into in Ireland and by the inappropriate measures that were taken to deal with it. And so I think it's hard for any of us to say something that's more shocking than what the church has done to itself, actually. Yeah. So I didn't feel I was upsetting people. I did feel a revival of my old bewilderment from the 60s and 70s, my own anger even, when my friend Pat Connor, the monk, was asked to leave Australia or stop operating in the Archdiocese of Sydney and was forced out for no good reason except politics. I did feel a certain... I wanted to emphasize that issue. He says that if he said before he died that if it happened now, he'd be able to make use of unfair dismissal law. But unfair dismissal law didn't operate in the 60s and 70s.
Do you think 1996 was the pivotal year for the kind of, I suppose, the big public backlash against the church in Australia? Like, I remember 1996, I was working in 2UE, a radio station in North Sydney, and I can always remember parents and grandparents ringing in to the talk show that I was working on. So disappointed within the church, so disappointed about how the church were handling all sorts of allegations. And that disappointment was palpable. Did it all kick off then, do you think? Did it all come tumbling down on them, so to speak, did it?
Yes, it was an era when there was great scandal, but the victims still didn't have a lot of traction. And it was before what has happened since. Father Patrick said to me in 2002, was that if the church didn't attend to the problem according to its best angels, if they kept on attending to it only in terms of protecting their assets and calling on their best legal minds, if they continued to do that, he said, the state will make them face it. And that's happened both in Ireland and Australia.
Tom, in your introductions, you write, I have come to realise that if you leave the church may not leave you. I'm just wondering, to what extent was were you, by writing Crimes of the Father, were you writing the church out of your system?
I suppose, I mean, I don't think it will work, but I'm certainly examining this issue. There's a character in the book who goes back to Ireland. Many of the characters in the book are of Irish descent, as you know, and so is Doherty. And one of the characters goes back to Ireland and sees a mass stone in Donegal and thinks of the penal days and of the barefoot people around a ragged priest. And she sees this mass stone and thinks, well, that's my inheritance. I've got to try to hang on to that. And I feel exactly the same. That I felt that my Catholicism was, for good and ill, very much an Irish version of Catholicism. It was Irish priests and nuns still around when I was a kid who taught me. And I felt that the faith of our fathers should not be lightly thrown over because it was very important to them. And it also gave them, well, a certain dignity. It might have been ambiguous, but it gave them a sense of who they were and a sense, a platform on which to fight for human rights. Human rights, very important in the church when I was a kid and when we're all working class people, as it was in the US with the Democrats when the Irish were all workers, the passion for social justice. And so I naturally wanted to write about that too. And I didn't want to, I find it hard to totally walk away, yeah. To totally walk away. I find it easy to walk away from the hierarchy and the curia, but the mysteries separate from that are another thing again. And so I stick by that proposition. It's easy to leave the church, but will the church leave you?
Do you still pray, Tom? Do you?
Well, I do meditate, and I think that's a form of prayer. I do go in for this very this meditation of the kind that Doherty does. And I submit myself to the authority of the universe. If that's a deity, so be it. Yes, I still, doctrinally, I wouldn't satisfy most bishops doctrinally in terms of what I believe. When I was a seminarian, my first big crisis, in the days when they said you've got to believe the lot, you can't select, was the virgin birth. I came to see that as hard to hang on to. I also didn't like the fact that so many people were cut off. You know, if you married a Protestant in a Protestant church, you were cut off. If you married him in a Catholic church, you were only half cut off, but you were married behind the altar. I didn't like, given that my parents were very passionate Australian Democrats, I didn't like the non-democratic aspects of the church. We see where they've taken us in the way they've dealt with this problem. If this is the best they can do, it's been catastrophic.
Can we talk a bit more about Doherty? What I really liked about him was that, you know, he can engage in those liminal spaces. You know, he doesn't need this absolute clarity on everything and this absolute certainty. He doesn't look at life from this brute black and white point of view. He really, I suppose, he really gets context, doesn't he?
Yes, indeed. And he knows that it's forces of history that have made him what he is. He knows that forces of history have made other people Hindus and other. He's very conscious. He's a very spiritual man by nature, but he's very conscious of the accidents of culture and of religion. And that's why one of the big problems of religion is that it's not only a framework of belief, but it's also, in many cases, a claim to be the one true faith, which puts you at loggerheads, psychological loggerheads, with the majority. And in Australia, the Irish were never a majority any more than they were in America, so they had to learn to be pluralists. But yes, he's aware that who we are is a product of history, and therefore he also believes in the universality of human suffering. And so the suffering of the kids who were abused, particularly the ones that killed themselves, as something that he can't walk away from. He comes to Sydney to warn the priests of Australia that their danger's coming if the authorities don't deal with this issue better. And he's trying to get back to Australia at the same time so that he can live with his or spend time with his aged mother, who is not at all. She's a very hard-nosed Aussie woman.
Yeah, I really enjoyed her character because she gives Doherty some superb advice. She's very frank and forthright. She doesn't hold back in any way. And, you know, she's very self-assured and shrewd. And she doesn't suffer from that sense of nostalgia that we're all crippled by and going back. She really looks to the future and looks forward. And she works with whatever her current reality is and just plows on, really, doesn't she?
Absolutely. Of course, the other characters are, the victims are a boy who has suicided, a woman who was a nun but is now a cab driver, and a very successful young man who is terrified that if he says anything about what's happened to him, he will lose his repute as a winner in society and a winner in business. I incidentally met a barrister recently who was like that, who couldn't face admitting that he'd been a victim until overtaken by a rage one day, and he ended up writing a book about it. And he's a characteristic victim of that type who succeed in part driven by the desire to escape what happened to them as kids, and who then come back mid-career to confront what that was that did happen to them when they were kids.
Father Doherty's brother Declan describes his brother as unconventional, but the real bloody deal. I love that because it absolutely encapsulates the man. You know, he's so creative with how he works with people and works with given contexts. And, you know, one of the other aspects or other attributes that I liked about him was that, you know, he intuitively is able to be present to people who are besieged with terrible feelings of anger and guilt and shame. He seems to really understand how to work with people's anger and how to, and you know, it is so compassionate to them, isn't he?
Yes, and of course, when he confronts the anger of abused people, he knows what it is. He's not offended by it. He's not threatened by it. He knows the deep, dark source from which it emanates, and that is a great strength of his as well. In this book, of course, it's a little bit like science fiction in that the victims get their justice. And it's only slowly that the victims are getting their justice in real life. But I wanted to give Doherty a bit of justice in his own lifetime.
Yeah.
And of course, the victims. We had an interesting thing that happened here as a result of the Royal Commission. Cardinal Pell declared that he couldn't come back to give evidence in Australia because he had a doctor's opinion that his heart wouldn't let him travel. And so Catholics in Australia raised the money to send every victim who wanted to go to Rome to watch Pell give his evidence. Everyone that had suffered under Pell's administration, not from Pell himself necessarily, not at all from Pell himself, in fact, although there are rumours that he is going to be charged himself, but we don't know if those charges are reliable. But victims that had suffered in his parishes when he was a young man, from other abusers, from people other than him, they all went to Rome and behaved with great dignity. They didn't interrupt the hearings. They just sat there and in the hope of justice. And I know, for example, a couple, one of whose daughters is has suicided, and the other one has had a bad car accident because of her alcoholism and is a permanent invalid. And both these people were abused in Melbourne. As I say, not by George Pell at all, not by Cardinal Pell. Those parents went to attend the hearing in Rome. And this was all paid for by Catholics who are outraged at what's happening. And I think that was a very eloquent gesture from them. A far more eloquent gesture than this book is, although I have written it as lovingly as I can and with as much sympathy for everyone as I can have. Thank you.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.
And you're very welcome back to Talking Books. I'm Susan Cahill. It's lovely to have your company this evening. Well, on tonight's show, I'm talking with one of the giants of Australian fiction, the great Tom Kenneally, on his latest book, Crimes of the Father, published by Sceptre Books, where Tom writes, "Priests are responsible to the law. They are required to be, and they are entitled to be. This gives them responsibilities under the law and access to the law." I asked Tom about one of his more formidable characters, Sarah, an angry, frustrated and hugely aggressive cab driver, a former nun and, sadly, a victim of clerical child sex abuse. I asked Tom how many Sarahs did he meet during the research phase for this book, as Sarah's story reads all too real.
Yes, I met a woman like Sarah, not exactly the same. You've got to fictionalise. People are entitled to their privacy. But I've met over the years a few of them. I've met mainly boys. You see, it happened while I was at school, but I didn't know what it meant. I saw the signs, and a few old classmates of mine said that the signs were very much eloquent of real abuse happening in private, not involving all the brothers that taught me. I'm only aware myself of one case, and I was never abused myself, and I learned a great deal from some of the men who taught me. But so as soon as you say one thing about the church, you've got to say something else. If the church were only the protective bishops and archbishops and cardinals, then it would be easier to condemn them. But the church is also the people who go out and sit with refugees, the nuns who go out and sit with refugees in our detention centres, and the priests who are activists on their behalf. And the church is a very contradictory institution at the moment. And I was trying to say that in this book.
Now, Tom, one of the interesting questions you do tackle in Crimes of the Father is on individual conscience. And you ask, can individual conscience trump a papal encyclical? Now, I'd imagine in the 60s and 70s, it was pretty much 50-50. But nowadays, you know, we've seen so much progress. We've had referendums on gay marriage, look at divorce and so on. And also in terms of, you know, how people are understanding their lives, we've evolved more. We've become more pragmatic as people, and we're looking into ourselves more for what is right and what's wrong, and then looking outward. So that, you know, the idea of a church dictating what is right and what is wrong really doesn't fit in with how we're living today. It doesn't make sense for people, or at least that type of approach doesn't make sense.
Yes, and of course you had that extraordinary referendum on gay marriage in Ireland, and I think the Catholics are increasingly following their own conscience on these matters. But Pat was one of the first people to tell me that that was possible, that you could stay in and follow your own conscience, that you had to take account of the seriousness of what the Pope said. But really, I thought Humanae Vitae, after the brief and ecstatic period of Vatican II, I think it was a means of getting us all back under the cloud of authority again. There are so many, there's so many complex issues that run contrary to Humanae Vitae. For example, my daughter was working in Dublin as a journalist at the time when there was a girl who'd been raped by her uncle, and she was underage. She was not allowed by a judge to go to England for the law, the case law of Ireland, and the statute law didn't let her go to England to be aborted. And why should someone with AIDS not use birth control? And so it's very hard. I feel very blasphemous running down in sick people, but I think our individual conscience, informed by from a number of sources, is ultimately the only way to go. And I think increasingly Catholics are going that way, that they're they are consulting their own humanity and their own sense of what they can live with, and are finding that therefore the church's doctrine on homosexuals and divorce and these are axes that exclude people. They lop off part of what could be the great community of humanity as far as the church is concerned. They lop these people away from the church. And I think it's not as if the idea that only the informed conscience of the Vatican, the word of the Vatican, is the only, that our consciences will be mediated to us. There's another bloke who held opinions like that. His name was Stalin. He believed that he was the mediator of all Soviet rectitude. Now, the Vatican isn't as huge a monster, isn't as monstrous as Stalin, but you know what I'm trying to say, that it's a totalitarian belief system, and there's no way that fully-fledged humans won't consult their own conscience now. But when I was young, you did think that you had to form your conscience according to Vatican authority. And I don't think we do now. I think people like Doherty, if he is still alive, he'd be an old priest now, he would consider that consulting his own conscience is part of the process as well.
Yeah, it's interesting, Tom, that both Maureen, Father Doherty's really close female friend, they've a really good commonality. They really get each other. They're both struggling with their own moral instincts and then the force and weight of the church tumbling down on top of them, aren't they? Their relationship is so interesting, though, isn't it?
Ah, yes, indeed. Yeah. They've had an infatuation and in the past. And something akin to love. And they don't get around to any sexual congress in the novel, though, of course, priests have the world over. Also, I think that the church should honestly confront the reality of the practice of its clergy and introduced a realistic policy that doesn't involve celibacy.
Yeah.
I think that the teaching of celibacy, it doesn't create abusers, because there are many married men who tragically are abusers too. But I do believe that the training, the attitudes of priesthood towards women are such that women become 51% of the population, who are a damn mess, who are a peril to shipping, to the shipping of the clergy. That they are the rocks on which a man's celibacy might run aground. Yeah. Terrible, terrible thing. Well, I think, as Roger Syke, the American Benedictine, says, celibacy is a wonderful beast. Much praised in mythology, but not always encountered in reality. Mm. And I think that it's time that we're honestly confronted too.
Yeah, it seems so harsh and so unrealistic to think that anyone can live a comfortable and meaningful life without a sense of intimacy or sexual intimacy, that there's no touch and feel there somewhere. You know, we're not robots, you know, we were born to reach out and to feel and all of that, you know.
It's good for people. It's part of our I've found my marriage to which I brought some of the immaturity lingering over from the seminary has been an education. My last three or four books have been written from the point of view of women. There have been feminist tracts, in fact, but very well disguised. In any case, marriage is an education if it works. It's also tough in its own right. It's not as if it's always a picnic, but celibacy neuters men for real life. And so the relationships they do form are often immature, and we see that in cases of the way they deal with women who bear their children. And there have been some cases along those lines in Ireland as well. So there we are. I'm probably already been excommunicated by the Bishop's Council of Ireland. I just asked them, pray for this sinner.
Well, speaking of sinners, Monsignor Leo Shannon made for a riveting reading. Despite the context and despite the creepy storyline, his character was so engrossing. He's a total opportunist. He's very vain. He's quite a tough nut in all areas of his life. But, you know, his opportunism leads him to all sorts of predatory behaviour. And it is also creepy. I'm just wondering, getting into his mindset must have been very challenging, because, you know, trying to understand that self-righteous type of mindset must have been uncomfortable.
Yes, he's a man who's never quite grown up. He is a type that you see who played the role of the churchman, not of the friend of Christ, not of the man of mercy. But the sort of, they play the game. Yeah. They are apparatchiks of the church. And they, of course, are the ones who often enforce the letter of the law, the acts of the law. And we've all met guys like this. And some of them tend, not all of them, but some of them are... the abusers also.
I'm just wondering, Tom, do you believe in all the truth and reconciliation approaches? For example, like meeting down and facing your abuser face to face, so to speak, and, you know, facing them down and looking for those answers from them. Do you think it leads to closure? Do you think it works? Do you think it can lead to these redemptive and transformative moments that victims need?
I think it, from what people tell me who have been in that situation and who have been abused, the acknowledgement is the most important thing. To say the institution has sinned, to also say, if necessary, I've sinned through neglect, and to do public penance. That's what these people all say they want. But they haven't had it. They've had legalistic evasions from the head of the church in Australia at the time when most of these scandals, many of these scandals occurred, from Cardinal Pell. And a fairly, a genuine apology, but not exactly sackcloth and mourning from the bishops and archbishops who were summoned before the Royal Commission, before the Australian Federal Commission into abuse of underage children. Everyone was caught by this, from the Boy Scouts to the Anglican Church and so on. It wasn't the Catholics alone, but the figures for the Catholic Church were appalling. But a lot of senior churchmen certainly take the attitude is, well, there are others that have abused children too. As Cardinal Pell said, we aren't the only cab off the rank. Well, you are the only cab that claims to be the ultimate authority on faith and morals. There's no one else doing that and being abusive.
Yeah.
So the sense that it's been a catastrophe is, I don't think it's penetrated, because we'd have senior churchmen on their knees begging for forgiveness, and that would be good for the victims.
Yeah.
It would be, in Australia, there's a certain traditional anti-church feeling, both from agnostic atheists and so on, and from the old Protestant establishment. But these blokes have created the problem by not attending to it properly. But if they're scared of sectarianism, they've done the worst job they could have.
Yeah.
But there's no profound repentance that I see yet.
And I would imagine, Tom, that that lacking of authenticity in saying, forgive me, I am sorry, has almost been a secondary violation to those who have experienced clerical sex abuse. Like the different ranging antics that we've seen, the squirming out, you know, the legal wriggling that we've seen, the pokey compensation systems, and the backlash that those who put their trust in the church have experienced from members of the church must really just break people's hearts and souls.
It does. They all say it. All those who've been through the process say that the evasions, the church admitted that they had been abused and paid them a small amount, but it required their confidentiality.
Yeah.
Now, all those confidentiality agreements have been declared null by the Federal Commission, so they're all out anyhow. The news is out anyhow, and there is a crisis that the leadership has brought upon the church, and the leadership does not seem to be struck by the weight and horror of it in the way that we ordinary people are. And when they are struck by the weight and horror, that will be the beginning of healing.
Yeah, when it eventually becomes level, because water finds its level, doesn't it? It eventually, you know, things eventually surface, don't they? There's no running away, sure there's not.
Yes. I think, though the hierarchy is probably not ready for it, there will be a certain democratization of the church, or else most people in the West will leave.
Yeah.
Because it's okay when we were, you know, Irish peasantry, like my grandparents, they needed the faith and they needed to obey, but life was much simpler. And now in the West, people aren't going to take whatever the Pope says without examining it. People aren't going to try to live to according to humanae vitae, if no matter what the health results for the woman. Women themselves have become stroppy people, and they should. And they've said, what about my health? You know, why are these men telling me what I have to do? And there are many Catholic women feel like that now. And that's healthy. And the church will become democratized, or those people will end up leaving it, I think. I'm sorry, I'm not an expert on any of this, but I'm just from observation and talking to Catholics about this issue broadly in America and occasionally in Ireland and here, when I was a little kid in the bush in Australia, we were raised with an Irish, strange idea of the Irish. They told us that you're all very devout, much more devout than us. And we were little barbarians from the bush. But the Irish never took the name of our Lord in vain. And the west of Ireland, everyone was a saint. And it's shocking to see that now in the west of Ireland, there's great suspicion of the church, where there used to be great devotion. And I don't think it's people's fault. I think it's the fact that the church has let them down. So I was in a literary festival in Listowel a couple of years ago, and I still kind of expect that the west of Ireland will be still holy and staunch. And let me tell you, it's not. talking to people out there. Of course, the people who come to literary festivals might be a fairly racy crowd, but there you go.
Last question for you, Tom. You have brought so many different aspects of the church into your writing life, and you've really interrogated different classical archetypes within the church. I'm just wondering, are you hopeful that the church will evolve and that we'll get much more of a meaningful dialogue between ordinary members of the church and the hierarchy? Like, do you think that's possible?
Well, I'm not as passionate about wanting the reconciliation, but I'm aware that many members of my family, many people I know and love want it, and many people I admire. And they're sophisticated people, and they want that reconciliation to occur. And so I hope, for the sake of all those people in Ireland, Australia, America, in Europe, throughout the world, that we do get a human reaction out of them, out of those guys. But the Curia seems to keep the Pope under close wraps, and maybe we ought to just get all the Curia to resign and replace them with my mates, the riff-raff priests I know, the good men, the men who have read novels, drunk whiskey, but are not whiskey priests, and who know what the world's like. I'd like to replace the Curia with them. In the meantime, God bless us all, says Tiny Tim.
That was Australian novelist, playwright and essayist Tom Keneally. Crimes of the Father is published by Sceptre Books and retails for just under €20 in hardback. Well, that's it for Talking Books for another week. I hope you enjoyed the show. All that's left for me to do now is to say a very big thank you to Ronan Brannock, who helped out with this week's programme, and the lovely Lee Duncan on sound. We've been Talking Books. I'd like to end tonight's broadcast with the insightful words of Buddhist teacher, peace activist and poet Thich Nhat Hanh, who advised, "My actions are my only true belongings." How true. Good night.
Talking Books on Newstalk 106 to 108.